You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection held another primetime hearing last night. The focus, what then-President Donald Trump heard, said, did, and didn't do in the hours on January 6th following his speech to supporters at the Ellipse. It was the eighth in a series of hearings by the committee. We learned that this will be the last one until they resume in September. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you watched or listened to this latest hearing, what stood out to you most? What questions do you have about it? If you're not watching them, are you following this in general? What do you think? Has this changed your mind in any way? Call 800-642-1234. And what do you want the outcome of all of this to be? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Alyssa Von Hagel is professor of political science and the gender studies program coordinator at UW-Superior. Alyssa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Before we dive into the details, Alyssa, big picture. I don't usually like to use the word unprecedented, but we have an unprecedented thing going on in American elections, a sitting president losing the election, saying he didn't lose the election, going through a wide variety of efforts to, I guess, lose it. Can you talk about this unique moment in American history that this committee is trying to capture?
Absolutely. I mean, you're spot on that this is truly, like, you know, unprecedented in our history. There's so much complexity surrounding all of the various aspects of it, so that adds to the remarkable nature of it all. But some point to the special hearings that were held, the Watergate hearings, when right before Nixon had resigned from office. But even then, they were very distinct hearings. And in that case, there was bipartisanship. Towards the end, Republicans convinced Nixon to resign. So the way that all of this is kind of unfolded has truly been a truly unprecedented point in American history.
And what stood out to you now from last night's hearing?
Well, there's a number of, you know, every hearing there's new, seems, bombs dropped, or perhaps that's not the proper way to say it. But there was, I think that, so there's two new witnesses that came forward. Both witnesses were White House employees who resigned that day of January 6th after what had happened. And they added more, you know, details and explanation as to what was going on in the White House. I think that what to me stood out is, well, there's many things that stood out, of course, but what to me stood out as one of the most remarkable aspects of the day is that for the, you know, for 3 to 4 hours, there was absolutely no contact from the sitting president, Donald Trump, to any law enforcement, military leadership at all. Whereas that call essentially came from Pence, from Vice President Pence. And so, you know, that to me is truly striking, that the sitting president, you know, seeing this unfold over hours and hours, took no steps to, you know, to deal with it, essentially. And it was the vice president who was making the calls, trying to, you know, have law enforcement respond to the actions at the Capitol.
We're talking to Alyssa Von Hagel, professor of political science at UW-Superior, looking at last night's hearing of the January 6th House Committee. You can join in with your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You just mentioned former Vice President Pence. We learned a little more about the situation he and his security detail faced in the Capitol on January 6th of 2021. This is from a White House security official. Note here that the audio was altered. This is an anonymous official altered the audio here to protect the official's identity. Here's a listen.
Members of the VP detail at this time were starting to fear for their own lives. There was a lot of yelling, a lot of very personal calls over the radio. So it was disturbing. I don't like talking about it, but there were calls to say goodbye to family members, so on and so forth. It was getting, for whatever the reason was on the ground, the VP detail thought that this was about to get very ugly.
And this, of course, we know they're part of the group of people in the Capitol were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." This particular audio suggesting that his security detail was fearing the worst at this point.
Absolutely. And that, I mean, I think this far out from the actual events that transpired, we kind of lose that memory of just the abject fear that so many people were facing and the violence that was taking place. And this is another reminder of, you know, how fearful and how violent, it was, the events were at the Capitol at this time. And truly it's horrific to think of, the Secret Service agents, or, whether it's members of Congress, their staff, were in similar precarious situations as well.
And the committee definitely emphasized what the president tweeted and when, and making the point that as the former vice president and his detail were facing this risk, President Trump had essentially tweeted that Pence was a coward, didn't have the courage to invent this power to stop the election. Do you see this committee trying to establish, I guess, culpability for the former president, whether in a legal sense or at least in a political sense?
I think with respect to the issue of Trump's response to the chance of hang Mike Pence and his complacency with and even seemingly support of that, those chants and potentially action, I think it's more of a political issue that, necessarily as a compared to a legalistic question. But certainly I think, it should, be a perhaps also an, perhaps an ethical or moral, issue as well, that in terms of his, support or at the very least complacency for, listening to, hearing this, and again, doing nothing in response to this.
Part of the question here has been on January 6th, to what extent was this just a protest that got out of hand versus part of a wider effort to block the outcome of the election? At the very end, the committee played audio from former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, convicted earlier today on misdemeanor charges of contempt for Congress, appeal expected there. But Mother Jones, the magazine, released some tape of him on October 31st, 2020. This is before Election Day, laying out to some people he worked with a roadmap for Trump and the election results. Here's what the House committee played last night.
And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. But that doesn't mean he's the winner. He's just going to say he's the winner.
The Democrats, more of our people vote early that count. Theirs voted mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to declare himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm.
And he went on in more detail about how chaotic things could get in that scenario. So even before the election, this idea that there will be no accepting of an election loss. How does that fit into this wider narrative?
I mean, I think his predictions that were found in that recording, I mean, virtually all of them came to pass. They came true, essentially. And yes, as you mentioned, he mentioned revolution. He mentioned violence of, whether or not, if the violence will come sooner rather than later, if it will come immediately upon, the day after the election or January 6th, that he repeatedly made reference to this notion of violence. And so I think, again, it shows that there is, at some levels, at least among some of his allies had foreknowledge or believed that January 6th would very well become a day of violence. And certainly that is, again, proving that Trump was aware of or part of these schemes is, another totally different legal question. However, the fact that there were White House allies, individuals talking about this well ahead of time is deeply concerning.
We're talking right now about last night's hearing of the January 6th committee. UW Superior Political Science Professor Alisa von Hagel stays with us. And you could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Did you watch or listen to last night's hearing or catch up this morning? Have you been following these? Does watching make for a different experience, do you think? What do you hope is the outcome of all of this, if anything? Do you want to see charges filed? If so, against whom? Or do you want to see these done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Elisa von Hagel, political science professor at UW-Superior, looking at last night's hearing of the January 6th committee. You could join in with your thoughts, your reactions, your questions at 800-642-1234. What stood out to you last night? Are you following these things? Are you hoping that there is some kind of outcome, whether legal or a message that reaches the American people? If so, which ones? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring out a caller now. Jane is with us in Eau Claire. Jane, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jane?
Oh, just that I've talked to several people who felt like they didn't want to get too emotionally involved in these hearings because they feel like we'll go through all of this, we'll have good evidence, and then nothing's going to happen at the end. So that's very frustrating. But as I watch it, I think, yeah, I think Trump and Rudy Giuliani and several of them should be brought up on charges.
Jane, thanks for the call. Elisa, Jane, hope something comes out of this, it sounds like, worried that it won't. What do you think?
Well, that actually falls in line with a poll that was just taken this past week, and with the majority of Americans finding that they do wish or do want charges to be brought in this particular instance, but only 28% believe that it actually will happen. So I think that feeling is in line with many Americans right now. And again, also the Department of Justice has been very slow moving and even investigating top officials or the former president. And so it does seem that as if, you know, for some people, it has been argued that, you know, some have argued that they seem to be sort of dragging their feet or not wanting to pursue legal charges against these individuals. However, again, they obviously still have time to do so. And with the things that have been uncovered over these hearings so far, there is increasing pressure to do so. So who knows, we may see some movement in the future, but certainly that is a very common concern amongst so many Americans.
That's on the legal side. Now, here's Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming appealing in her remarks, a political outreach, I think, to perhaps some of President Trump's supporters. This is from her remarks yesterday.
Here's the worst part. Donald Trump knows that millions of Americans who supported him would stand up and defend our nation were it threatened. They would put their lives and their freedom at stake to protect her. And he is preying on their patriotism. He is preying on their sense of justice. And on January 6th, Donald Trump turned their love of country into a weapon against our capital and our Constitution.
What, Elisa, do you think of that rhetoric directed, I think, at President Trump's supporters in this case?
All right, and I think that she is correct. And I would also add that, anything that has come up in these hearings, the bombshells that have been dropped from, numerous different individuals testifying, that there's a core group of Trump supporters that still do not waver at all with their support of the president. Certainly he does not have anywhere near a majority of support amongst Americans overall. And amongst Republicans, his support is declining. However, again, there are that core group of supporters where their support for him will not waver seemingly regardless of what comes up. And so it's, whether or not that group of individuals can be reached or can be this can be discussed with, I think, is at this point perhaps not the best political route to go. But certainly there has been perhaps some shift in the Republican Party among some individuals.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yes. So I liken this whole thing to a boater being out in front of a beach in Southern California, chumming the water. And they're throwing all kinds of chum in the water, and the sharks come in, and they attack the swimmers, and a few of the swimmers die, and others get bit. Not all the, this whole thing, what Trump did and all his allies, to me, reminds me of just that sort of scenario.
boater out there, chum of the water, and for anything that happened. I'd love to see Bannon in jail and most of Trump's henchmen, and I wouldn't lose any sleep if Trump himself spent some time in jail.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Elisa, members of the committee, definitely try to connect the dots to what President Trump said, did, and then didn't do on the afternoon of the 6th to the violent outcomes, as our caller says, like throwing chum in the water.
Absolutely. And I think even the efforts that the committee made to emphasize that Trump was repeatedly told by aides, by top-level officials, by his family members that there was no voter fraud, that he lost the election, that, you know, trying to, you know, tell him, impart upon him, you know, that this claim of voter fraud is simply not true. However, with the Steve Bannon, release of the Steve Bannon tape, or reviewing it now in this particular context, it seems as if that was sort of part of the strategy as well. And so I think the calls for violence is part of that, as the caller mentioned, the sort of chumming the waters. But certainly even just the emphasis on the voter fraud that continued from the day after the election through, well, even till today, is also part of that same activity.
We're talking to political scientist Elisa von Hagel from UW-Superior, looking at yesterday's January 6th House committee hearing. Back to your calls. Larry is with us now in Onalaska. Larry, hi.
Hi. Since the maybe the George W. Bush administration, we've had a situation which has been clearly demonstrated in these hearings of people in roles of leadership who are consciously and purposefully lying and misleading the public to their own ends. And we still have apparently a significant portion of the population knowing that these people are lying, knowing that these people have lied and have consciously attempted to manipulate them. But because whatever causes or programs they endorse are consistent with the views of those voters, they'll still vote for these people. And so these people stay in office, they stay in roles of leadership. I just wonder if the whole society is not being corrupted by the fact that we're consciously encouraging people to be dishonest.
Larry, thanks for the call. Lisa, big picture, Larry's worried about the corruption of our government, of our society, based on misinformation.
Absolutely, and I think that is a major issue today, especially with so many issues, not just this, of course, but issues related to climate change and the role of science and policymaking and the distrust or just simple non-belief in, you know, scientific studies, or whether it's vaccines or climate or what have you. And so I think that this is a very critical and crucial issue for the U.S. and the world in general, but specifically, it also pertains to this issue as well, where the truth doesn't really seem to matter. The facts are your facts, but they're not my facts, you know, so to speak. So I think it is a very, very crucial issue, and it's not something that's easily fixed or changed in terms of trying to encourage the proper channels to find to trust with respect to scientific information or just simple claims of information from public officials. So absolutely, it's a very critical issue that we need to address.
Larry, thanks for that call. I want to look ahead now. This committee is on break through August, but they're planning to come back in September. And here's Representative Liz Cheney kind of foreshadowing what's coming up.
Efforts to litigate and overcome immunity and executive privilege claims have been successful, and those continue. Doors have opened, new subpoenas have been issued, and the dam has begun to break. And now, even as we conduct our ninth hearing, we have considerably more to do. We have far more evidence to share with the American people and more to gather. So our committee will spend August pursuing emerging information on multiple fronts before convening further hearings this September.
Now, of course, we don't know what they have now and what they'll be working on over the next month. But Elisa, what What questions are on your mind that you think could be addressed in future hearings?
I think many of the individuals that have not yet testified and have been subpoenaed, some of whom have been held in contempt, perhaps they may have, you know, they may be able to have some of these individuals come in for closed depositions to get information from them. So that might be a critical part of the piece of the, you know, larger puzzle. There's a number of, I believe, 5 or 6 members of Congress that have been subpoenaed and have refused to participate. And so, again, perhaps, you know, there might be some involvement either of them or aides that may lead to, you know, new avenues or new information that was just simply previously unknown at this point.
Alisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Alisa von Hagel, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Superior. She talked with us today about the House January 6th committee's last hearing until September, that hearing in prime time last night. You can still share your thoughts, email ideas at WPR.org, and follow coverage of everything, all political news at WPR.org. We'll have coverage of state news, and we provide coverage from NPR as well at WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Congress is working on a Respect for Marriage bill aimed at protecting same-sex marriage in the event of a Supreme Court reversal of past rulings on the issue. We're going to take a look at the proposal and what it could change, and you can join in and tell us what you want to see Wisconsin senators do. They've both been talking about that issue in the news. Plus, we'll find out why women of color may face some of the biggest consequences of the end of Roe v. Wade after that U.S. Supreme Court ruling, and abortion bans kicking in Wisconsin and elsewhere. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's summer camping season. That means campfire cooking. On this week's edition of Food Friday, a cookbook author shares her love of cooking outdoors and some favorite campfire recipes. First, there's a big gender imbalance when it comes to housework and household planning in the United States. While things may have changed a little over the years, women still end up doing a lot more of that work, even in households where both spouses work full-time outside of the home. Our next guest says couples are happier when that work is divided up more evenly, and we can learn from examples of couples that have figured out ways to keep things more equal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this in your household? Does one partner do a lot more of the housework? And how about keeping tabs on all those details, especially when kids are involved? Or have you made efforts to balance things out? What worked? What didn't? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Kate Mangino is a facilitator and gender expert who works with international nonprofits. Her new book is Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the basics here. When we've got a couple, both partners are working full-time or thereabouts, and let's stick with a man and woman couple for now, though you look at different configurations. What do we know about how the housework breaks down in that kind of household?
So what the word that a lot of researchers use nowadays is neo-traditional, which is the most common couple that we see in North America right now. It's both parents or both partners do work outside of the home, do contribute to household income, but the vast majority of those household chores falls on one person over the other. And in different sex couples, the trend is that it falls on the woman, that she does about twice as much work in the home than her male partner. So if you think about quantifying that over time, if a man puts in 10 hours a week doing chores, caregiving, whatever, she's putting in 20. And over time, that really adds up to a very significant amount.
And let's talk about what we mean by work. And I'll own up to something here. A lot of times I used to think about just the doing of stuff, you know, washing the dishes, going to get groceries or whatever. And I think we're pretty close to even, my wife and I know all guys probably say that, but I think we were close. But there was a whole nother category that I didn't take into account. And you talk about in your book, some people call it emotional labor or cognitive labor. I call it logistical the planning, the keeping tabs on stuff, the agenda. And boy, if when I started mapping that out, that was very much not even. And I wasn't doing more of it. That's pretty common, right?
It's very common. And I appreciate you having that introspection and talking about that, that there is the doing. There are the physical tasks. And that does take a lot of time. It's unloading the dishwasher, folding the laundry, cooking food, doing grocery shopping. And that does take up a lot of time. But you're right. What I call cognitive labor, but it has lots of different terms. It's really kind of project management work. It's anticipating what needs to be done. It's looking forward. It is managing time, managing schedules, not just, you know, not just RSVPing to that birthday party invitation, but calling the parents of the kid whose party it is. What kind of presents do they like? Making sure you have time to stop and get that present, making sure you wrap it in time. There are all these little mini steps that happen in every process around the household. Decisions have to be made. There's always some sort of monitoring process. Did I make a good decision? Do I need to make changes in the future? And all of that cognitive labor is very exhausting, to be honest. And it's often not tracked in data, because we ask couples and research to take notes in time journals. But cognitive labor can happen when you're in the shower, when you're driving to work, when you're exercising. And we're often not capturing the hours that people spent doing cognitive labor.
You make the case that, you know, this setup isn't great for the partner who ends up doing all the work, but it's also kind of bad for the person who's not doing so much work. And when you started to look at couples where things were more evenly divided, both parties ended up being happier. Why is that?
Precisely. I think that it's easier to notice how it's harder for the woman, for the cognitive laborer. We see limitations in her professional life, in her income earning ability, in her emotional health and day-to-day happiness. But we also see that in her male partner. When men are pigeonholed into that income generation role, when they are only seen as someone who helps out in the home but really doesn't take responsibility for contributions or cognitive labor, we sort of, I would say, subconsciously push him away from caregiving roles, from emotional bonding, from having deeper relationships with children, deeper relationships with their spouse. And for research for my book, I identified and interviewed 40 men who are living as equal partners. So they meet my definition of doing half of the physical and cognitive tasks in their home. And when I interviewed them, I asked them, you know, what did you have to give up to live this way? And they very quickly corrected me and said, oh, no, I'm not giving anything up. I am living the life that I want to live because the rewards far outweigh any sacrifices. I have meaningful relationships with my family members. I don't have to act a certain way. I don't have to posture. I can be my own genuine self. And that those kind of relationships were really worth it for them. It was more important than having some extra leisure time.
Talking to Kate Mangino about her new book. It's called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Madison. Mary, hi. Are you there, Mary? Not hearing Mary. Let's go to Steve then in Sun Prairie. Steve, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Obviously, I haven't done extensive research, but I have a lot of male friends, and we have conversations about these types of things. And the consensus seems to be, at least with people that I know, is that men do the outside work, the back-breaking stuff, and women seem to do more of the internal stuff of the house. And the reasoning why that is a lot of the men gave up, because women have a certain way of doing things, and if the man deviates, it causes friction, as opposed to the woman being more open-minded that there might be a different way of doing things. So it's easier for the men to say, you know, I'm not going to focus on that.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Kate, this is something you heard in your research from the book. This is not just Steve and his buddies we're talking about here.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that Steve called in and raised this point. You're absolutely right. Traditionally speaking, women do indoor tasks. And they're also routine tasks, things that have to happen every single day. If you skip a day of cleaning up the kitchen or you don't feed the kids, you know about it. That's not something you can give up easily. Whereas men tend to do outside coded tasks that are intermittent. So if you do skip a weekend of mowing the lawn or you don't get the light bulb switched, you don't necessarily notice it. So mail-coded tasks have a bit more flexibility. And in that flexibility, there's a bit more choice and room for not just error, but room for, you know, something different, right? So if you do skip your tasks for 1 or 2 days, it's okay. Whereas female-coded tasks tend to be those relentless things that have to happen every single day. And I also agree with Steve that sometimes we have this notion that there's a right way of doing things and a wrong way. I talk about this head on in my book. I realize it's an unpopular topic sometimes to bring up with women, but maternal gatekeeping is a very real thing. And this all plays back into our gender norms, which I really get into in detail in the book. And I talk about how we raise boys and girls differently. We raise them to have different values. We raise boys to value income generation, and we raise girls to value domestic work. And that very much translates into the roles that we take on as adults. And sometimes a woman, oftentimes, and I'm guilty of this as well, we value ourselves based on the level of cleanliness in our home, what kind of lunches our kids pack for school, how cute the Halloween costumes are on October 31st. And men don't feel judged for those things in the home. They kind of get a pass. So that does translate into bickering in the household about who's going to do what the quality level is, taking control. I think it's really healthy for couples to have a conversation. What do you feel like you're judged for? What do you feel like you have to do? And to see if you can mix up some of those chores a little bit. So, you know, women are stretching themselves to do more male-coded tasks and vice versa, so we don't get trapped in these patterns.
Steve, thanks for that call. And Kate, that all points to, I think, a key takeaway of your book, which is not men are lazy. Am I right? It's these are things
not.
Coming from a much deeper, a long-term historical place.
Absolutely. We are all survivors of gendered norms and gendered upbringing. And they're all connected to each other. What women are raised to do is directly connected to what men are raised to do. And I think it can be trapped. It feels like a trap for all of us. And it can be a little bit suffocating. Some of us are okay with our gendered roles. We're quite comfortable with it. But those of us who don't really naturally fit with what we're supposed to do with our gender identity, it can feel very limiting.
We're talking to Kate Mangino about her new book. It's called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a frustration in your house? The division of household labor, maybe between two working parents, say. What are some of the frustrations? What are some of the solutions you found along the way? If you have advice, maybe to share with others, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with gender expert Kate Mangino. Her new book is called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about our guest research, or maybe the experience in the household you're running right now, or the one you grew up in. What did that division of labor look like? Did it cause stress? Did you find ways to work through that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Alyssa is with us in Sparta. Alyssa, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So my partner and I have been together for about 15 years and married for 10. He's male. He's very willing to help with things, but I have to prompt that or request that assistance with household tasks and children, et cetera. And it's like the observation is not as present with him as it is for me. So I often have to anticipate the needs. He's unable to do that. I'm just wondering if the author could speak to any research that she gathered in writing the book, if that's kind of typical of relationships.
Thanks for that call. Alyssa, I'm guessing, is very much not alone, Kate.
Alyssa is definitely not alone. I'm really thankful that you called in and shared that personal story. But what you're explaining is very much on par with what the majority of American households are experiencing in that neo-traditional relationship where one person is really sort of the manager of the home, and the other person takes this helper role. And as you've experienced yourself, and a lot of us have experienced in the past, being that manager is incredibly time consuming, and making a list of tasks for someone else to do is in itself work. And then, of course, you have to do all the follow up to make sure that they've done the work. So, you know, I think one thing that I try to propose in my book is that we haven't reached gender equality, that this is not as good as it gets. We are absolutely in a better place than we were in the 50s and 60s. We've come a long way. But I'd like to think of ourselves right now at a milestone and not an endpoint. And I think that this helper supervisor role where we seem to get stuck right now, I'm hoping that with enough conversation and intentional work, we can continue on this pathway and in the future decades really get towards something that feels more equitable.
Alyssa, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Kate, I can think of all sorts of bad ways to tackle the problem of unequal division of housework. But you, the heart of your book really is those 40 people you talk to who really exemplify a more equal way of doing things. What were some of the things that struck you first and foremost about how these couples made that happen?
So it was really interesting when I learned it, when I, you know, talked about where they sort of came from. They were 40 unique stories. They were 40 men from around the United States, a few in Canada. Really didn't see too many patterns in their upbringing. Mm-hmm. A few patterns, like a quarter of them came from single mom households, but not too many unanimous stories. However, when it came to making it work now, they all had the common belief that this was best for them because they wanted to have a great solid relationship and that this made them happy, that they liked contributing, that they wanted to be an equal partner. Both to support their spouse's professional life, but also to support their spouse's emotional health. So I think that the commonality was about how they live today as opposed to where they came from. And in terms of tactics, you know, I heard lots of different ideas. Some people had weekly check-ins. Some people had monthly check-ins. Some people spoke more spontaneously. But all of them had very open communication with each other. And they really tackled the cognitive labor and made sure to divide that. Some people switched on and off. So for a year, one person would do all the feeding and the other person would do the laundry. And then they would switch so that no one felt like they were stuck doing a job they didn't want to do. There were lots of different examples. So I think there's many ways to be successful.
We're talking to Kate Mangino, author of the new book, Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your household experience when it comes to how you divvy up the tasks and the planning of those tasks. Maybe some solutions you found along the way. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kate, part of this is a mindset thing. One thing that struck me, at least one of the men you talked to, maybe more than one, took the role of the idea of a man as a provider for their family and kind of rethought that. And it might mean bring in money, but it might also mean, you know, providing that a meal in the morning for a kid or providing a clean home. Can you talk about that sort of twist on the mindset?
Absolutely. I think we've long coded men as being the providers, right? And sometimes we think of it in an old-fashioned way of sort of bringing home a paycheck. But providing for your family can look like many different things. It could be time spent. It could be caregiving for an infant or an older family member. It could be taking care of laundry or cleaning or pets. There's lots of different ways you can provide for your family. I had a great story from a man named Jack who's up in Vermont. And his wife is a physician and made enough money for their family. And he didn't need to bring in extra income, but he had two little kids and his wife had a demanding job. And he realized what I need to do to provide for my family right now is to be present and to spend time with my kids and be the parent who is home and who's there for them. And so he took a different job that would allow him that time. So I do think that, and this is something that I think the greater community could do. This isn't just about individual nuclear households, but if all of us collectively embraced this idea that parents provide for their family in lots of different ways, and instead of coding it about what men do and what women do, just think about what parents do as a whole. Yes, we bring home income to buy physical things, and we provide time and caregiving as well.
You also, in your book, try to learn from same-sex couples who, you know, they can't just fall in naturally to the gender roles they grew up with. What kind of things can we learn from them?
So data shows us that, on a whole, same-sex couples are more equitable than different-sex couples, but still fall into this female-coded role and male-coded role. Oftentimes, especially this happens with kids, because the school day is shorter than the work day. Doctors and dentists and daycare providers and camp directors ask for one parent contact, right? So one person automatically sort of has an expertise in the domestic work, and one person, you know, has an expertise on income generation. But I do think that same-sex couples are, on a whole, sometimes more willing to try something different because they've already been forced to think through their own gender identity in the past. So, but I do think it's unfortunate and interesting that they can fall into gendered patterns even when their own gender doesn't match that role that they're exhibiting. And I think that's another important idea, that these are roles. They're not connected to us biologically. They are things that we perform because of what we learn in our society and what's role modeled to us.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I wanted to share that when I was first married, the biggest fight that I had with my new husband was whether or not we were going to hire a cleaning lady, because he said we weren't the kind of people to have a cleaning lady. And I said, well, I was. And anyway, he ended up liking her so much, he would buy her favorite soda and everything. And I did win that argument, I guess. But
Kate,
I didn't feel like cleaning either. So,
Kate, thanks a lot. Kate, again, I think this might be a pretty common argument.
It is a common argument. I'm glad that she brought up that this happened early in her relationship. I've gotten some early feedback from readers in their, in their 20s, like the younger millennials and the Gen Z who are just starting out. And they didn't, they had this sort of unspoken feeling that things weren't quite balanced in their new households, but they couldn't put it into words. And they're finding this idea of cognitive labor helpful, so that it's something they can talk about early in their relationships and set some boundaries for themselves. So good on you for setting a boundary about how to maybe outsource some work so that you both have equal time for leisure.
Thanks for that call. And briefly, Kate, as we wrap up, it seems like the key is to think and talk about these things, because if we don't, we're just going to fall into a pattern that may not be great.
Absolutely true. I think that that's the number one learning here is, have an intentional understanding of what those gendered roles are. Think through what's been role modeled to you. What do I like? What would I like to repeat? And what are the things that I might want to change for my life and for the next generation?
Kate, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
That's Kate Mangino, facilitator and gender expert. We talked to her today about her new book. It's called Equal Partners, Improving Gender Equality at Home. You can still share your stories. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. A cookbook author and camping pro tells us how to make delicious meals on your next camping trip. And you can share your favorite campfire recipes. You can get started right now, by the way. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about your campfire cookery favorites. And check out some recipes from our guest, WPR.org/Food Friday, to get ready for your camping trip, maybe this weekend. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.